We're starting a little late this morning because coffee was a little late this morning, and therefore everything is a little late this morning. So, but the coffee is now available, so we can get started. So I was telling Kathy this morning that this class has been harder for me than I think any other class I've ever done on one aspect, which is trying to figure out what order to say everything in. And that can be characterized by the fact that we're now at week four, and I'm finally going to give a definition of evangelicalism. And so evangelicalism in the late 20th century had kind of as its core beliefs the inerrancy of the Bible, the importance of the cross, eternal punishment and reward, salvation through conversion, actively seeking change both in the spiritual and physical realms, and individual personal piety. So, a belief in the inerrancy of the Bible, the importance of the cross, a belief in eternal punishment and reward, salvation through conversion, an active seeking of change both in the spiritual and physical realms, and individual personal piety. The first three are, I would hope, pretty obvious to everyone: inerrancy of the Bible, importance of the cross, belief in eternal punishment and reward. Salvation through conversion is Billy Graham style neo-evangelicalism of the late 20th century. There's a stress on conversion, on change, on growing up one way and becoming something else. We all believe in regeneration, that you must have your heart of stone taken away and be given a heart of flesh. But in evangelicalism, there's a stress on this being a very obvious event in your life and something that occurs later in life rather than in childhood. Again, it's a stress. It's not a saying. There is never any case in which people become converted prior to their being fully aware. But in the teaching, in the preaching, there's this stress on a moment in time in which you can point to for your conversion. When I say active in seeking change both in the spiritual and physical realms, I mean that self-identified evangelicals, being a part of evangelicalism is a strong desire for evangelism, personal evangelism, that you would be involved in the converting of other people, that you would be making a difference in the world by speaking the gospel to people. So you would be actively involved. To be an evangelical, you couldn't be a closet evangelical. You had to be actively involved in trying to bring about the conversion of other people. And then when I say active seeking change in the physical realm, you also, if you were a self-identified evangelical, then you wanted to see society and culture better reflect the teaching of the Bible. So you were actively involved in seeing the physical realm become more like the kingdom of God. And then when I say individual personal piety, I mean what is stressed are the acts of individual piety. So your prayer closet, your personal Bible reading, your small group study, very little stress then on the corporate nature of piety, like going to church or the Lord's Supper or those things that we do corporately. The stress was on individual piety rather than on our relationship together and corporate piety. And just to give you, just to kind of drive this home to anybody that's like my age or, within 10, 20 years of my age, either direction, who went to college and was part of college fellowship groups. Think about how many lectures and how many books you heard and read about your personal quiet time versus how many lectures and books you heard about the importance of being at church on Sunday. The stress was on your personal piety. So individualistic or individual personal piety is a stress. The actively seeking change, both in spiritual and physical realms, salvation through conversion, eternal punishment and reward, the importance of the cross, and the inerrancy of the Bible. And we've been talking about how there were certain men in the early, late middle part of the 20th century. You just connected to the Bluetooth, didn't you? We actually can connect to the Bluetooth through the sound system. There you go. So, again, I've said this earlier, and I want to reiterate now, learning all these names is not the important part of this lecture. It's understanding the narrative. But we talked about men such as Billy Graham and Akinjay and Pugh and Carl Henry who had this desire to move beyond the fundamentalist modernist controversy of the early 20th century and establish a new evangelicalism. Carl Henry actually referred to it as neo-evangelicalism, as the new evangelicalism, and he was convinced by the other guys to not do that, but to simply refer to it as evangelicalism. They were redefining the term. So I mentioned to Dennis today that, you know, part of what we're going to do today is define evangelicalism, and he said, biblically or sociologically? And what we're doing is defining it sociologically. How was the term used? How did evangelicals understand themselves, and how was the term used in the late 20th century? And these men, to a certain degree, were extremely successful in what they wanted to accomplish. They were extremely successful in accomplishing it. So it's just fascinating to think that in the early 20th century that Bible-believing fundamentalism, a belief that there are just certain things. And there's a sense in which all Christians are fundamentalists. The Westminster Confession is fundamentalist. It says that faith is believing whatsoever the Bible teaches is true. Faith is believing that. If the Bible teaches it, faith agrees to it. So the Westminster, in one sense, is maximalist. There's another sense in which it's minimalist, where it says, but there are certain truths that are key and core. And so in that sense, we all have a certain level of minimalism to us. And the minimalist in the early 20th century was laughed at, that you would actually think that the Bible was inerrant, that you would actually think that supernatural things happen in the world or have happened in the world. We were idiots. We were living in the past and not living in the present, if we thought that way. But by the end of the 20th century, the mainline churches who had adopted that modernist approach to things, they were then, by that late part of the 20th century, they're seen as the traditionalist fuddy-duddies. They're trying to play catch-up to the evangelicals. They're bringing in the praise bands and trying to look like contemporary evangelical churches because they're playing catch-up. Billy Graham and Akinjay and Pugh and Carl Henry, they completely rewrote the narrative. They redefined the terms, and they rewrote the narrative, and they were successful in that sense. And the mainline church has been declining. The mainline church reached its peak in every denomination. Lutheran, Presbyterian, Baptist, Methodist, they all peaked in the early mid-60s and have been on a steady decline ever since. And part of that is the rewriting of the narrative and the success of these men. Because remember what we said, what they wanted to do was create, they saw these distinct denominational believers. You know, there was the OPC, there was the Presbyterians, and then there over there were the Bible-believing Methodists, and there were Bible-believing Episcopalians, and there were Bible-believing Anabaptists, and there were Bible-believing Pentecostals, and there were Bible-believing, and they said, as separate groups scattered in that sense, we have no power, no ability to take on the liberal main line, because they were big and influential and powerful. And so what we need, thought these guys, was a big enough tent, a big enough umbrella, that we could get all these groups under it and then be able to speak to the world as a united voice, and then be an agent for change. Because remember, part of being evangelical is believing you need to be an agent of change, both spiritually and physically. And without this big umbrella group, thought these gentlemen, then we could not do that. And so so to do this, one of the things they did early on to try to create this big umbrella group that could speak for Bible-believing Christians in every denomination, they started the National Association of Evangelicals. So the very guys who are setting the course for evangelicalism, very early on. They start Fuller Seminary in the late 40s. Billy Graham becomes famous in the late 40s, and they start Christianity Today in the early 50s. And they also, in that same time period, I think early 50s, they start the National Association of Evangelicals, and this was going to be the glue. In their mind, this was going to be the glue that held all these dispersed groups together. And they're founding all sorts of, we've talked about Bible Study Fellowship and InterVarsity Christian Fellowship and all these parachurch groups that come out of the mid-20th century and begin to grow. The National Association of Evangelicals was going to be kind of the organizing group, the big group that would kind of bring all these different groups together and be able to speak with one voice. Now, how many people in the room, I do want to show of hands this time. How many people prior, I mentioned the National Association of Evangelicals a few classes back, but other than that, how many people have heard of the National Association of Evangelicals? About, not quite half, I'm guessing, all right? How many people in here are members of the PCA? Well over half. Congratulations, you are all members of the National Association of Evangelicals. This group you have never heard of, because one of the ways that the National Association, remember, we want to be influential, we want to have a name, we want to say we represent big numbers, so they didn't just try to recruit individuals, they recruited denominations, and so in 1973, when the PCA was formed, they joined the National Association of Evangelicals. And so when the National Association of Evangelicals goes to politicians and says, we think you should vote this way, we represent X number of people, you're one of those X, even though you'd never heard of them before. The problem, the reason why, I'll suggest, now here I'm putting on my sociologist hat, the reason I would suggest that we've all heard of Billy Graham, that we've all heard of Focus on the Family, that we've all heard of Campus Crusade, and most of us haven't heard of the National Association of Evangelicals unless we're just really into that sort of thing, is that evangelicalism at its core is driven by a culture of celebrity. That Billy Graham model of a culture of celebrity is really at its core what holds it all together, but at the same time is what keeps it from being completely united. A famous church historian of the who's still alive, by the name of Marsden, said that evangelicalism is much like the feudal system of the Middle Ages, that you have these evangelical lords that then have their people under them and that follow them and do what they say, and that instead of one big umbrella, what we have is all these little fiefdoms. And so you are regularly doing the Bible study that's on the Billy Graham website with your little group, or you're going to Ligonier seminars, or you're a part of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship when you're in college. You have your little fiefdoms, and most of these fiefdoms have significant celebrities at the top, especially in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Now, as they move on into time and the celebrity, the founding celebrity dies off, then they do tend to become more institutional. So it is fascinating to me, that you go to, and I love Ligonier, and one of the, part of the material I'm using for this class comes from Ligonier. But it is fascinating to me. You go to Ligonier, and there's still, pictures of R.C. Sproul, and you can still get R.C. Sproul's podcast. I'm like, how does he podcast from heaven? Even in our circles, the celebrity culture is really the driving force behind evangelicalism. And so evangelicalism, one of the criticisms of 20th century evangelicalism, is that the relationship between the individual evangelical and the institution that he follows is that of a consumer and a business than it is of a family. It's more comparable to a consumer and a business than it is a family, whereas the church is always described in terms of family. So you can think of evangelicalism as a lot like, Home Depot, where what's great about Home Depot is that you can walk in and find just about anything you need to, fix your house or whatever it is that you want to do from a Home Depot's perspective. It's pretty much there, unless there's some sort of supply chain issue caused by government's strange reaction to a disease. Other than that, you can go into Home Depot and find pretty much anything that you need, but you need to go into Home Depot knowing what you need. You go into Home Depot as an individual. You don't go into Home Depot going, I have absolutely no idea how to repair my sink. Please help me figure out how to repair my sink. You only go into Home Depot if you already know how to repair your sink. In the same way with evangelicalism, you go into evangelicalism as a consumer, getting those things that you already feel that you need, and trying then to find answers to the needs that either you don't know you have or you don't know how to fix, you're not going to get that because there's really no one there to help you. And the other thing about the consumeristic mentality of evangelicalism is that if for all its desire to have an impact on the world, consumerism will inevitably ignore that which is most needed. All right, so here's how I would say that. So you go to Home Depot and you find there that everyone is either rude or, I'm not saying they are, but this, if you go to Home Depot and you find that everyone is rude or unknowledgeable, you ask the person about, what's the difference between this paint and that paint? And they're like, I ain't got a clue. So they're either rude or they're unknowledgeable, or because they're just salespeople. They're just there to get stuff off the shelf into your bag and out to your car. And eventually you go, the people at Lowe's, they're a little bit more helpful, or they seem to know a little bit more. And so I'm going to quit going to Home Depot and I'm going to start going to Lowe's, right? I have nothing against Home Depot or Lowe's, so it's an analogy. It's not like that at all in family, right? In family, you don't get to pick One of the common factors about family is you get the family you get. You don't get to pick them. You don't get to pick your parents. You don't get to pick your children. You get the family that you get. And the less valuable the family member is, the more attention they receive. So if you have a family in which a child with special needs is born, the family will often end up having to dump all of its resources into that child. And the church is like that. But Ligonier Ministries is not like that. As much as I like and use Ligonier Ministries, there is a difference between the church and Ligonier Ministries. And it's the difference between a business and a family. So, evangelicalism then stressed the new birth or conversion, kind of shifting gears slightly, to the point where everything else, again, remember, evangelicalism is a minimalist movement. Everything else is secondary, especially ecclesiology, especially the doctrine of the church. And so it becomes a completely different way of passing the faith on to the next generation. Evangelicals' strength, so this is from D.G. Hart, another church historian, evangelicalism's strength lay precisely in its ability to appeal to individual choice rather than on a reliance on patterns of ascription and inheritance which characterize traditional religions. Unlike older forms of Christianity that pass the faith on to new generations through the family and church by means of birth, baptism, catechism, and worship, evangelicalism locates the primary mechanism of religious identity in the sovereign individual. And so it's all about you and your choice. And what I've got to do to make you make the right choice is to market it properly. If I can get my sales material slick enough to convince you that I've got the right product, then I've won. And that was exactly the strength of evangelicalism, and it did win the day, as it were. It did become dominating force in late 20th century Christianity in America, and even a dominating force in politics. But the question becomes, how does that stand over the generations? Can that hold? And there's a sense in which evangelicalism is really, late 20th century evangelicalism is really 19th century, is just 19th century revivalism in a different package. Because it's 19th century revivalism that is trying to be the church of what's happening now. It's trying to use the techniques of the marketing of the day to win souls. 19th century revivalism has the same core value of the sovereign individual being the key to what we do. And so you see this, you see both in late 20th century evangelicalism and 19th century revivalism, the stress on conversion, on earnest devotion, on evangelism, on holiness, on enthusiasm. What's important is in worship is how you feel, not what you believe or what is taught. A stress on minimalism is both in evangelicalism and 19th century revivalism, and what we've already talked about in terms of pietism, where piety is stressed to be completely individualistic and loses all of its corporate aspect. Prior to the mid-20th century, when historians would look at Christianity, they would discuss four dominant groups in America: Baptists, Anabaptists, Holiness Pentecostal, and Reformed and Confessional. were the four distinct groups that they saw in America. So, okay, first, what's the difference between a Baptist and an Anabaptist? A Baptist and Anabaptist walked into a bar. Oh, no, Anabaptists won't walk into a bar. The Anabaptists of the Reform, of the time of the Reformation, didn't just have rebaptizing as a key component of their thinking, but there was a great deal more to their thinking. And so the Anabaptists of the Reform period are characterized today. We see them in the Amish, the conservative Mennonites. Those are the Anabaptists, the Quakers of the 1900s. Those are your Anabaptists, as opposed to Southern Baptist, which is Baptist. And then Holiness Pentecostal, these are both the what we think of as the Church of God, but then also certain branches within the Methodist Church. The Pentecostal word, meaning those which have believe in special gifts of the Spirit continuing on into our day, and the Holiness Movement being that group that believes that perfect righteousness, perfect sanctification was attainable in this life. I actually had a conversation with a gentleman one time that told me he had not sinned in the past 10 years, and that's that Holiness Movement. And then Reformed and Confessional is the Dutch Reformed, but also Episcopalians because they have a confession, and Lutherans because they have a confession. Those groups that have a tradition and a history that they write down and hand out to the world and let them take pot shots at it. You know, that's the nature of being confessional. You state what you believe, you plaster it for the world to see, and let them try to shoot it down. But then after the success of Billy Graham and Ockeny and so forth, most of the writing, church history writing, past 1980 is not about the church. So they would write, church history saying, here's what Anabaptists believe, here's what Presbyterians believe, here's the strength of Methodism, here's the strength of Lutheranism. That would be the way church historians would write. Now they talk more in terms of movements, the evangelical movement, and you write about the evangelical movement, or you write about the moral majority, or you write about the evangelical right. You're talking about a movement rather than a group. And one of the interesting things about that is the different ways you would have to determine the strength of a movement versus a church. So if we wanted to talk about, when we talk about the strength of the PCA versus the decline of the PCUSA, we would say things like, membership is growing in the PCA. Membership is declining in the PCUSA. Giving is growing in the PCA. Giving is declining. New institutions are being founded in the PCA. So many missionaries are being sent out each year. PCUSA, institutions are closing and fewer missionaries are being. So you would have numbers that you would use to determine the strength or weakness. What sociologists and historians have to do in terms of evangelicalism is surveys. You base it on surveys, and we've already talked about some of those surveys that occurred in the early part or in the 1970s. But one particular set of surveys were done in 1978 and 1979, which have been very influential in the way people think. There were changes that came about in the 80s because of the election of Reagan, and I'll get to that. But in 78 and 79, so remember, Time magazine declared 1976 the year of the evangelical. And so suddenly everybody wants to know, what's an evangelical, how does he think, and what does he do? Well, it turns out it's not a he, it's a she. Evangelicals, the surveys of 78, 79, evangelicals were mostly white, more female than male, middle-aged, married, rural, southern, and behind average in education and income. (laughs) 20% more women than men self-identified as evangelicals in the surveys of 1978 and 79. In the late 70s and 80s, during the time of these surveys, not everyone who identified as evangelical also said that they voted Republican. But the more active you were in your religious activity, the more likely you were to vote Republican, they found in the surveys. In other words, conservative politics in the late 70s was beginning to emerge as an indication of evangelical devotion. And it's in 1979, about this, you know, this same time, that Jerry Falwell forms the Moral Majority. He founds the Moral Majority. And so evangelicalism, it's really in that late 70s and in the early 80s with the election of Reagan that evangelicalism shifts to being very active in the political arena and being seen as a player in the political arena. But D.G. Hart said, over the next 40 years, they would find, evangelicalism would find, that electoral politics proved to be a difficult arena in which to persuade the breadth of American public that the narrow way of faithfulness was best. Let that sink in for a second. That over the next 40 years, evangelicals would find that electoral politics proved to be a difficult arena in which to persuade the breadth of America, of the American public, that the narrow way of faithfulness was best. We had shifted in evangelicalism. We had shifted from Billy Graham crusades to political rallies in evangelicalism. And these are broad characteristics. It's not that it's not like Ligonier Ministries is out there trying to win people for the Republican Party. But in general, we'd seen this shift. And it's interesting that to me that we saw this shift in the way to think about Christians from the 1950s, where we thought of them primarily denominationally, to in the latter part of the 20th century, and even up to today, thinking of them in terms of the movement to which they belong. And because I don't have any post-COVID statistics, but pre-COVID statistics, one in five Americans, 20% of everyone in America was still attending a church on an almost weekly basis. And most of those people would say, you know, this, what we are doing here in this church is right, and what they are doing over there in that church is not. And yet, both of them evangelical believers in that sense of believing in the Bible inerrancy, believing in, and the fact that we do that as Americans, that we still in large numbers are in churches that we think are being biblical, it's strange that historians then lump us all together as if there was no real distinction between a Lutheran and a Presbyterian, or between a Presbyterian and a Baptist. That's not even kind of on the radar. And so Hart points out that Protestants in the 16th and 17th centuries, and even into the 18th century, had looked to baptism, the Lord's Supper, the preaching of an ordained minister, and a system of family worship and catechesis as the staples of Christian devotion. Protestants in the Pietist and Revivalist orbit, the evangelical orbit, questioned the authority of such activities. Instead, private Bible reading, prayer, small groups, personal evangelism, and exemplary deeds of mercy become the born-again Protestant way of genuine devotion. Evangelicalism stresses the new birth to the extent, to the exclusion of almost anything else. And so evangelicalism really, in so many ways, breaks the ties that that we have between us and what came before us. The inherited wisdom of the ages is broken by evangelicalism, because of evangelicalism must sociologically appeal to the lowest common denominator to keep the big umbrella, and to the what's happening now to complete its personal evangelical, its personal evangelism and the conversion of souls. And ironically, Lewis Smedes, who was a professor at Fuller Seminary, which is, you know, the founding evangelical seminary, said, evangelicalism is a fantasy. For all the cracks in the earthen vessel notwithstanding, it's the church and not an ism which Jesus Christ founded to be the carrier of his great treasure. And so it was like what made them successful in the late 20th century was also their greatest weakness. And so we can appreciate the evangelical movement for its desire to keep the first things first. We can admire it for its ability to speak to the culture, but ultimately it is quite lacking in its ability to see the fullness of what God has for his people in Jesus Christ. I have a couple other things, but let me stop there to see thoughts or questions. Yeah.
Okay, so I grew up in a church where I regarded myself as an evangelical. It's a Baptist church in Ohio. And I think the one thing that I'm not hearing to like bring forward more into the discussion, that a lot of times when you're looking at the history of what's going on in the church, the thing we always have to keep in mind is that the culture itself is constantly changing. And if you look even at, say, the website out there that has the taxonomy of the Presbyterian Church, if you look at that, you can see that, you know, there's like five or six different branches of Presbyterianism now. And the way they came about is because as the culture changed, the church adapted. They shifted in order to meet the challenges of the culture. I mean, it was slavery in the 1800s, and then it was Darwinism in the late 1800s, and now we have you know, homosexuality and transgender stuff, and all of these things that come into culture cause shifts and changes within the church. And the church, I think, has to constantly adapt in a sense by maintaining the relevancy of, and I could say the inerrancy of Scripture applied to the human condition, continually adapting to or adjusting to what's going on in the culture in order to stay relevant. So I do believe that what Billy Graham and other evangelicals in the 1900s was awesome and really did change things. Just like, you know, the revivals of the 1700s and 1800s also made significant advances in the church. But I wouldn't totally just denigrate the evangelicals on the basis of, well, they've become irrelevant. What they were actually trying to do was adjust to the changing culture and meet the challenges that were in many ways very successful.
Right. And so, yes. I think part of the problem, though, is it's changing to the culture that is the problem in the first place. So going back, go back to the your mentioning of the split, the fundamentalist modern split in the early part of the 20th century amongst Presbyterians. It wasn't the fundamentalists who were adapting to culture. It was the liberal who was saying, "This is what's happening now." And so often our attempts to meet the culture halfway, that's what gets us into trouble.
I didn't mean to imply that I believe we should adapt to the culture. I didn't mean to imply that at all. But I am saying that we still have to. They have a message. We have to have a counter message that continues to affirm what the Scripture teaches. And I think that's that in his day.
Right. But you do that by speaking the truth, not by adapting to the techniques or the thought patterns of the time period. And so we'll actually look at, please don't run me out of the church, we will look at music sometime in the next 2 weeks, because music has been a big part of that how do we adapt to the culture in which we live? And is that adaptation a positive or a negative net plus? We often think of contemporary Christian music as being something that happened in the 1970s, but really there was a whole set of contemporary Christian music created in the early 1800s as a part of the revival movement. And so contemporary music is not a contemporary thing. And so we'll be looking at that. Matt?
Yeah, well, just by way of kind of response to that, the church should not change. It ought not. But we certainly have to talk more about some things sometimes than others, right? So right now we're talking a lot about homosexuality and transgenderism. 100 years ago, the church wasn't talking very much about that. Church doctrine hasn't changed, or Orthodox doctrine hasn't changed. But we suddenly find ourselves having to talk a lot about it because of what's happening outside our walls. Right, and so just by way of example, I think that's how I would sort of put it. Right, the Bible hasn't changed, but what we talk about on any given day, the issues that we encounter are different, and therefore our emphasis may look a little different as we're doing evangelism, as we're making disciples, being the faithful church, just because that's what the other people want to talk about when we're engaging them. Do you think that's fair?
Yes, I do. I just kind of a very old time example of that. This might be new information for some people in this room. Nowhere in the Westminster Confession does it say women can't be ordained as teaching elders. Nowhere in the Westminster Confession do they address the issue of male-only pastors. Now, here's something that is a key component of who we are as PCA, right? And yet, our document that we say defines who we are doesn't address it. Matter of fact, I went through all the proof texts. You know, so what are the 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 2, is that right? The two texts for what an elder is supposed to be, Titus 1 and 1 Timothy 2. And I went through all the proof texts in the Westminster Confession. They're never referenced. Those two passages are not referenced anywhere in the Westminster Standards. Why? Because nobody was asking that question in 1645. Right? You don't need to say women can't be elders in a culture in which where that's just universally agreed to. They were addressing the issues of their day. So when the mainline Presbyterian in the 1960s started having women elders, they did not have to change the confession to do it. They had to change the Book of Church Order. But they did not have to change the confession in order to do it. And so, yes, what you speak to will often have a lot to do with what's going on in your culture. And so we do need to speak.
Mm-hmm. Following up to what Matt said, how does all of this fit in with the pulpit? When did the pulpit start changing?
All right, that's a good one.
What we said on the daily in all these individual churches all around is what we will become. I put it on the pulpit because I'm simple.
Yes.
Preachers were preaching junk.
Yep, that's why. Yeah, I said that a couple of weeks ago. The reason, what made it possible for true believing Christians to continue to sit in those liberal churches that weren't preaching the gospel is that they were actually getting fed in their parachurch organization. That's where they were really being fed. They were hungry. If they're a Christian, they're hungry to hear their father's voice. And they're not hearing it in the pulpit, so they're hearing it at InterVarsity or Bible Study Fellowship or whatever, you know, or Ligonier Ministries, whatever your group is. That's where you really heard. Now, so I'm going to back it up just one step, buddy, and part of my proof for this idea that late 20th century evangelicalism is really 19th century revivalism is that, in essence, Billy Graham claims that for himself. If you go to, I am going to get to your question about the pulpit. If you go to Asheville to the Billy Graham Museum. you'll see there that this timeline of evangelistic preachers. You've got Billy Graham, and then going back through time, you've got Billy Sunday, and then going back, you got Charles Finney, and going back, you got George Whitfield. Billy Graham saw himself as the latest member of a long line of revivalistic preachers. That starts with Whitfield and comes forward, and so I think the pulpit begins to change. Buddy, because we started to judge the pulpit. So I'm living in New England. All right, let me back up one step further. Southwest Virginia. My grandfather, when he was in his 30s, the church that I grew up in was a five-point parish, meaning they had five different preaching points, and they weren't more than 3 to 5 miles away from each other. Because not everybody had a car in 1930. And so the preacher would be the one that would travel a distance to the church rather than, like now, people travel a distance to the church. Then the preacher would travel a distance, and he would preach at these five different, very small preaching points in this rural setting. And so in that rural setting, you didn't have the internet. It's 1930. You don't have television. You have a radio, maybe, and you can't travel to Florida to go see R.C. Sproul, right? And so your pastor was your source for biblical teaching because you couldn't even make it 3.5 miles down the road to the other congregation on Sunday morning. So take that analogy and go back into New England in the early 1700s, and you live in a parish system where your church is the church in town, and everybody is a member of that church, at least in the sense that the pastor sees himself as the pastor of the town. And he was your pastor. Even if you didn't believe that stuff that he taught, he was your pastor. And if you had some sort of need, you went to him, even if you just didn't thought the whole thing was hooey. Then Whitfield shows up, and he starts preaching in the open air, and people get on their horses and travel from far distances to hear him. And they sit there and go, you know, that guy is better than my local preacher. And it's the beginning of the sovereign individual in the choice of religion in America, and so it became, you know, as I see my flock being attracted to this or that or the other, then I start to emulate this or that or the other, and I think the stress on old time religion, meaning the faith handed down once for all times, not meaning 19th century revivalism, but that faith passed on that Paul talks about, faith that's passed on to us once for all times, becomes secondary to what can I do to get people in the door. And so I think the pulpit became the pulpit of what's happening now, whatever that happening now is, whether it be liberalism or revivalism or therapeuticism or entertainmentism, whatever the ism is, the pulpit became that thing in order to get people through the door. There's a church here in town, I knew of their existence. They're not like one of the biggest names in town, but there's a church here in town, and I knew about them. I knew about somebody who was just starting to go there, so I pulled them up on the website. They have three worship services: traditional, contemporary, and modern. So traditional is what you would think it is. Contemporary is we play, it's sort of like traditional, but we use music from the 80s and 90s. It's all the best music from the 80s and 90s. I mean, it's basically how they put it on there. It sounded like the radio station in their description on the website. All the best music from the 80s and 90s. That's contemporary Christian music, is the 80s and 90s. The modern service is all the best music of today. So it's only stuff written like since the turn of the century. And along with, and this is a quote, haze and the best mood-setting technology available to us. H-A-Z-E, haze, which I can only assume means fog machine. Haze, H-A-Z-E. So that's what made it modern. And so that's the... And I can't wait to see. I want to go back to, I hope I live another 20 years so I can go back to the website and see what, do they have four worship services, or has the traditional become the traditional? And then what do you call the fourth one? There's too much baggage with that. I think it's got to be neo-modern or neo-contemporary, or I don't know.
Real question, is the preaching the same?
Yeah, and I don't know. And
maybe God will just shut the door.
Right.
Mm-hmm. When you were talking about different parachurch ministries, there would be people in liberal churches who would go to be fed.
Yeah.
I guess the presupposition with that is that what the parachurch ministries are teaching is, I guess, more orthodox maybe than a liberal church. Kind of going off of some of the other questions of, like, you know, the church becoming more liberal and responding to those cultural changes, why is it that the church pulpit was changing, but maybe some, and I can't say, you would be able to say more definitively, but maybe the church pulpit was changing, but those church ministries were remaining more orthodox? Like, why was that?
Well, see, I think the pulpit changed first. So the majority of the Protestant pulpits become liberal in the early part of the 20th century. And then it's the mid part of the 20th century that the parachurch comes into being. So it's a response. It's not like the parachurch remained faithful while the pulpit declined. The pulpit declined, and the parachurch came into existence as a response to that. And then we also, just to kind of, as a way of reminder, we said last week that Schleiermacher, the father of, you know, modern American liberal, or modern liberalism, modern Protestant liberalism, Schleiermacher believed that theology and truth were relatively insignificant. And what was important was love, love in action, love of God, love of fellow man. To follow Christ is to act out in love. And so it wasn't so much that what, there was the social gospel being preached in the early part of the 20th century. But you don't even now in the mainline church, there's just not as much of that. And really, what became the dominant preaching voice in the liberal church was be good to your neighbor, be kind, be loving. And who's going to sit there and go, I ain't listening to this anymore. This is evil. He's telling me to be kind to my neighbor. And so they didn't feel, they knew that they needed more, and so they went and got that somewhere else. But they didn't see the evil. They didn't hear the evil. They didn't had no idea what their pastor actually believed, because he never said from the pulpit. He just said, love God and love your neighbor. And you went, okay, I should love God and love my neighbor, which is true. But it's just such a narrow slice of the truth was the problem.
So, Ricky, you're fabulously setting up my upcoming class. The comment about churches going liberal, and I appreciate Elizabeth's question, I think we have to distinguish what we mean by that.
Because you have, as far back as Schleiermacher and the German historical critical people, they're denying the inerrancy, the truth of Scripture.
Right. And that's the
everywhere we are now flows from that. Right? When in Machen's time, when the mainline Presbyterian Church, you know, is denying miracles, denying the virgin birth, denying the resurrection, people weren't standing in pulpits with a rainbow flag performing gay marriages and putting their pronouns in their email signature block. Right? That wasn't a thing, right? They weren't there. But that all flows from what they were saying.
Yes.
Because once you abandon the truth of Scripture as the rock upon which your epistemology, your knowledge is founded, then all bets are off. So we're going to be looking at that as we work through Truman's book and looking at how we've gotten to this place where you can make a coherent statement that says, you know, the man who gives birth. And that's a meaningful statement. So, but it all comes down to, first you give up the Scripture, and all else flows from that. Talking about a church going liberal, it's not, it doesn't always mean the same thing. And we've certainly got, there are Bible-believing churches, some in our denomination, who will say they believe the Westminster Standards and the Scripture are true, but are advocating for a level of cultural engagement and adaptation that I don't think anyone in our session would be comfortable with.
Kind of going, your point's bigger than what I'm about to say, but part of that I would stress in what you said was, no one was arguing for homosexual marriage or even or homosexual ministers or homosexual members, in, you know, practicing homosexual members in the 1920s. But it makes perfect sense that they would be now, because remember the Schleiermacher's view is that we just need to love one another and accept one another and care for one another. And so in that worldview, if that's the driving force of your thought, then accepting the homosexual for who he is and loving him the way he is and affirming who he is makes perfect sense in the Schleiermacher world where love wins. You know, so that phrase that we see stuck around in signs in people's front yards, I mean, that's Schleiermacher. You know, love wins. Love is the key. An outpouring of one. It's, yeah. Right. But you're just getting ready, buddy, to ask all sorts of questions that don't matter. Like, is Christ really God? Is Christ really alive in order to love today? It doesn't matter whether Christ's alive today or not, from a Schleiermacher perspective. You know. But we would say that's eminently important for us to know if Christ is alive today or not. And so, anyway, we've run past our time. Thank you, and we will pick it back up next week.